So tonight's the night where I thought I would talk about bowing. And I don't know if the laughter last week when I was relief that you weren't going to hear it last week or or regret that you weren't going to hear it last week, but you'll hear it this week. About bowing, like this. There's a saying that's sometimes said that if there's no bowing, it's not Buddhism. And now that's a kind of an interesting saying, given how little we bow. At least in the American Vipassana scene, the American mindfulness group, there's a relatively little amount of bowing compared to what happens in Asian Buddhist traditions. And actually in Asia, there's a lot of bowing. Bowing happens all the time in Buddhist environment. It's a cultural way of greeting also in Asia, but it's also in Buddhist circles and monasteries, there's a lot of bowing that happens. Jack Kornfield, who was a monk in Thailand and did a lot of this bowing, he has a saying that he likes to say that when he was a monk, if it moved, he bowed to it. And the saying at the San Francisco Zen Center is, when in doubt, bow. I can't. No, you bow anytime. You see them and you bow. I counted once when I was a monk at Tassajara how many times I bowed from the time I woke up in the morning around 4 o'clock in the morning until about 10 o'clock in the morning. So that's 6 hours. And I think I counted something like 42 or 54 times that I had bowed in that 6 hour stretch. There's a lot of bowing. And one of the experiences that touched me very much on a Zen retreat was I sat, the person who sat opposite me, from the walkway in the meditation hall, was a Japanese priest who was visiting and sitting there for the 7 day retreat. And the way it works for these Zen retreats, at the beginning of the first day of the retreat, they come around and they hand you a teacup. Because every afternoon around 3 o'clock there's tea. You get tea and a cookie. And in a kind of ritual way, kind of in the meditation hall in silence. And so the first day you're given your cup and you're served tea in it and you have your cookie and you eat your cookie and you drink your tea. But then you keep that cup for 7 days. You keep it next to you where you sit. And so every day when they come for tea, they come and offer you the tea in a teacup that you have for those 7 days. At the end of the 7 days, the last day of the retreat, they come along, at the end of the tea ceremony, they come and pick up that teacup and take it into the kitchen to wash, put it away. And so I was sitting opposite this Japanese monk, and when it was time for him to kind of return his teacup, there's a lot of bowing, but but he bowed extra. And what happened was, before the server came to pick up the teacup, he bowed to his teacup. And then he picked it up. And, you know, then he offered it to put it on the tray and the server took it out of the meditation hall. And I was so touched that someone would bow to an inanimate object like that, a teacup. Why would he bow to a teacup, after all? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I don't know, I never asked him. But I was kind of touched the sense of maybe a reverence or gratitude or appreciation that he had towards the teacup that he felt that he wanted to express before he put it away, gave it up. And it was very touching for me, the idea that we could be grateful of the things that we use in our daily life. So rather than having a utilitarian approach to our cups and utensils and our cars and whatever, there's a sense of maybe reverence or gratitude or appreciation for the service they do to us. And seemingly he wanted to express that by bowing. And bowing is often very troublesome for Americans, especially I think Americans coming from Protestant and Jewish backgrounds. the idea of bowing seems like, you know, you're bowing to an icon. And, you know, especially if it's a Buddha statue, you know, it's even worse. And also it seems to go against perhaps American or Western ideas of individualism, ideas of asserting oneself, of being special, of me first. It kind of whatever it is, it kind of goes against the grain for many of us, the idea of doing a lot of bowing or bowing. And there, I think in Europe there's more bowing than in America. I grew up, part of my upbringing was in Europe, and I remember learning to bow. Sometimes when I shook people's hands, I would bow sometimes. I don't think we do that in America. So much. But, you know, you shake their hand, kind of, but we bow together and bring our heels together sometimes.
In Germany.
But the idea of bowing. So in America, it's not really kind of natural. It doesn't come easy, and it seems very foreign. And I think it's because of the foreignness of it that when American Vipassana teachers came back from Asia, didn't include a lot of the bowing in when they introduced mindfulness meditation. And we're kind of the legacy of that. We want to offer that. We think that mindfulness meditation is a really powerful and wonderful practice in its own right. And we don't want to feel that, we want to make it available to people who are not interested in Buddhism. And so we have a lot of this ritual, like the bowing. It might turn some people off who otherwise would benefit a lot from the practice itself. So we've kind of cut back. But I thought today, I often get questions about the bowing. Some people ask, you know, some people seem to bow at the end of sitting and some people don't, and what's going on here? And I, you know, so there's interest in the subject, so hopefully you're interested in today. So there's a kind of, but there is a kind of uneasiness that many Americans feel about bowing. And maybe this is why Suzuki Roshi, who founded this San Francisco Zen Center, first, in Japan, they bow a lot. You know, in the monasteries. And in the morning service, the morning kind of chanting, the morning ritual they do after meditation, there's a lot of bowing, which they kind of faithfully reproduced at the San Francisco Zen Center, because it's a Japanese Zen monastery, kind of. But Suzuki Roshi, after being in America for a while, he added 6 more bows. The first thing they do in the beginning of the morning service is they do, in Japan, they do 3 full prostrations. We actually bring your head all the way down to the floor and then stand up again. And he felt that it was good for Americans to bow. And so he added 6 more, and that, you know, that kind of shocked the Americans. And he said that he thought it'd be good for them because he thought his students were very self-centered. And he thought that bowing is a wonderful practice to help overcome our self-centeredness. He said, Suzuki Roshi said, this is a very interesting statement. There is no difference between zazen, or no difference between meditation and bowing. Bowing helps eliminate self-centered ideas. So both sentences are interesting, but the first one, he doesn't see a difference between meditation and bowing. And I think that's also true, certainly not in the physical, it's not true in the outer form, but in the inner form, the inner attitude or feeling. The inner expression that happens with sitting and with bowing can be said sometimes to be the same. And it's just, if you don't like the idea of physically bowing, I think it's the inner attitude, the inner aspect, which is really profound and important for a religious life. It's not necessary to bow, but I think the inner attitudes that often come with bowing are part and parcel of a religious life, of a spiritual life as it deepens. So I hope that as I talk about bowing some, that you can appreciate, or we can appreciate, have a renewed appreciation of the depth of mindfulness practice itself as a religious practice. And I'm aware, I was thinking about this afternoon, that it might be impossible in this sense to explain what bowing is, or explain it in words. It's probably best understood by doing it. It's one of these great things. By doing some things are only understood by doing them. And if you hold yourself at a distance from them and try to understand and read books and all this stuff, you'll never really understand the inner meaning or the inner sense that comes with bowing. That was certainly my case. I started doing my bowing when I came to the San Francisco Zen Center. And I just did it because you're supposed to. You know, you're it's a part of the ritual. You 42 times before 10 o'clock in the morning. And you bow to everything. You know, you bow to your cushion before you sit. You bow, you bow before you enter the zendo. You bow just everywhere. And I just did it because it was what was expected. And what was very interesting to me was that the bowing itself, by doing the bowing, an inner disposition, an inner attitude, an inner sensitivity seemed to arise. And it's not so clear if it was caused by the bowing, or rather the bowing gave an expression to something that was being born inside of me through all the practice I was doing, all the meditation I was doing. So maybe it's best understood by doing it, taking it on and experimenting with it. It's something to be felt deeply within, deep within our bones, in a sense. Oh, so in thinking this afternoon about talking about bowing, I was inspired to use the example of Chinese nature paintings, maybe kind of idealistic or romantic idea we have of them or of what they are. But there are these beautiful Japanese kind of ink paintings. Maybe you've seen them, of these kind of big cliffs and mountains, and they're kind of these beautiful large nature scenes. And there might be a river through it or a lake, or it's actually kind of a big panorama, the ones I'm thinking of. And it's quite beautiful and serene and peaceful, and everything seems harmonious and fits in quite nicely. But then if you look kind of closely, you see in the painting a human being, maybe a farmer farming, or someone in a little boat crossing the river, or someone kind of climbing in one of the mountains and one of the trails. And the person feels as if they're kind of fit in harmoniously in the nature, as if they're part of nature, not different from nature. It isn't like, you know, the Mona Lisa, which I saw recently, where, you know, Mona Lisa's there with her smile, kind of, and nature. It was quite revolutionary for Leonardo da Vinci to add nature. But it was kind of still in the background, right? Kind of through the cave wall in the back, far away. And here, it's the kind of reversed, where nature is kind of in the forefront, in a sense, and the human being is a little piece in this grander scheme of nature. So the idea being, perhaps, that the human beings are part of nature, inseparable from nature, but they're nothing special. They're not like this great, you know, it is not this anthropocentric idea of human beings that they should control and have dominion over nature, or they're the main thing happening in nature, the most important thing happening in the universe, but rather just, you know, a small piece of this much larger whole. And many people have been inspired by these paintings, this sense of relationship of humans with nature, being at one with nature, perhaps. So maybe this is kind of a romantic ideal, but the opposite of this, I was thinking of, is not being in harmony, to be in resistance with reality, with the world. So then an example for this last week. I was together with a friend. It was necessary to talk to another friend, a third friend, about some how to say it? A kind of a deep personal attachment, and that was kind of a shadow of this person's life, and it was causing this person a lot of trouble in his life, and it had gotten so much trouble that we felt it was necessary to go and kind of compassionately and kindly kind of point out this attachment and this problem and have a discussion about it, and as to help this person kind of see what was going on and try to kind of make their life a little bit easier. And so I kind of prepared myself and tried to kind of really speak from the point of view of kindness and what was really necessary and compassion. And both of us were very careful in talking with our friend, and it was very painful and difficult for the friend to hear. And at some point, perhaps because it was so painful and so confusing and so threatening to some of the core issues in this person's life, he kind of got on the offensive and started lashing out at me. and kind of saying, well, you have the same thing, you know, and you do that, and when you do this, then it's trouble for me, and why don't you do different, why aren't you different than who you are? So I kind of understood that the person was just kind of felt trapped and threatened, and in that kind of energy was trying to kind of find some balance or, you know, whatever. But I didn't understand it well enough. So I got defensive. Hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm not that way. And then it became a discussion about me and us and our perceptions. And that wasn't what we were there to talk about. And I had gotten caught. My self-identity and ideas and whatever had gotten hooked, but put up resistance to my friend kind of returning what we were doing to her and him in kind. So, and it would have been easy enough to just kind of let it just go right through, just right by. And it was no need for me to kind of take it defensively or get upset or be concerned or try to defend myself or explain myself. And we could have just stayed kind of focused on what we were really there to talk about, which was my friend, in a kind of compassionate, caring way. And so here was an example how I'd set up resistance, in a sense, to nature, to reality, to what was going on. So what is it like to live a life where there's no resistance? How many times in our life do we get angry or upset or clinging or make, when it's really not necessary in the situation? It would have been completely fine in that situation. I would not have been diminished as a human being. I would not have been disrespected. I would nothing. If I had just kind of nodded and said, oh, oh, okay, and just not picked up that that, you know, that ball was thrown into my court, and I chose to play the ball, and then I got kind of worked up. I wouldn't have been diminished one bit by just letting it go right by. And I wonder how many times in our life we would not be diminished as a human being by just simply not picking up the ball that's served to us, and just kind of letting it be. So I'm thinking now about Hakuin, the great Zen master, who in the 17th century, as the story goes, there was a young teenage girl, single woman in the village, who got pregnant from one of the local young men or boys. Maybe he was kind of lower class, lower than she was. Anyway, it was a rather embarrassing situation. So, and I guess she wanted to protect her friend. So when she was pregnant and was noticed, and her father got very upset and asked, you know, who's the father? And she said, oh, it's that monk, the monk Hakuin down at the temple. So when the baby was born, the father brought the baby to the monk and said, you know, you're the father, you take care of it. And Hakuin said, oh, is that so? That's all they said. Oh, is that so? And then he took the child to raise it and was, you know, took care of it compassionately and as best he could. And after some time, I don't know how long, this daughter, this woman, decided that, you know, she wanted the truth to come out, and it was kind of painful to be separated from her baby. So she confessed and who the real father was. And then her father then felt quite bad and went to the Zen monk Hakuin, was very apologetic and said, I'm so sorry to have accused you of, you know, of something you didn't do. And, you know, I apologize and like to have the baby back. And and Hakuin said, oh, is that so? And gave it back. Oh, is that so? So he just kind of accepted the way things came. Oh, is that so? And didn't, you know, he didn't get, there was no resistance to it. There was no fighting it, and no trying to defend himself or his reputation. And I doubt he was diminished one bit by it. He just kind of took care of the situation as it was presented to him. And then it also occurs to me that, again, famous, there's many stories. I believe that these are true stories, because so many in all Buddhist traditions, but I think of the Zen ones, of the old Zen monks who feel that they're close to death. And they can feel, they kind of sense a premonition that they're about to die. And so they get up into meditation posture and die. You know, no resistance to death. So this idea of no resistance, being part of nature, being part of the flow of change of nature, and not feeling we're separate or we need to defend ourselves or resist anything, a part of it, I think is a very important part of living in a happier way, in a freer way. And it's certainly what Buddhism teaches. And this is, in part, this is kind of one way of talking about the Four Noble Truths. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, can be described as being resistance, resisting the way things are. When things are inevitably moving in certain directions and you can't change them in any kind of way, to resist that, to want it to be different, or to want it to be more of the same when it's going away, to resist what's inevitable, what's absolutely going to happen anyway, that is a source of suffering. And perhaps that's why Hakuin realized, you know, and he just went, oh, is that so? Or to sit up when you're about to die. I think it's a beautiful way to die, you know, rather than, you know, thrashing about in fear. Resisting, you know. Imagine resisting your death. It's time for you to die. What a waste. So when there's no resistance, in Buddhism sometimes we say there's also no separation or no duality of self and other. No sense that the I as a self, you know, independent or different from nature or from others, other people. And or there's a kind of sense of being, sense of aliveness, sense of no resistance, where there's both allows for both self and other in a kind of harmonious, non-resisting involvement with each other, engagement with each other. And now, bowing in Buddhism involves putting your hands together, usually flat together, but sometimes kind of cupped together. And symbolically, it's sometimes said that this coming together represents this experience of non-resistance to life, this experience of non-separation, non-duality. That the dualities of good and bad, right and wrong, self and other, sacred and profane, whatever dualities you can think of, come together and are harmonized as one. And either you can say there's, you know, self and other disappear, good and bad disappear, or what some people would say, that they both exist together with no resistance. And I like that, bringing it together with no resistance, because inside of ourselves, we're actually multidimensional beings. And we're, in a sense, saints and sinners. We're, in a sense, kind. There's kindness within us, and there's criticalness within us. There's compassion within us, and there's hate within us. And to accept all of us who we are, not to leave anything out, to kind of accept and be honestly accept, honestly recognize who we are in all our facets, not to deny some of them or resist some of them, but to really see, this is who I am. And then to kind of accept it all. You know, and this kind of coming together and somehow accepting and not having to resist it or fight it, in Buddhism is considered the beginning of happiness and harmony and peace. So bowing, in part, is an acceptance, an honest acceptance of who we are. And that's really what a lot of what mindfulness meditation or practice is about also, is honestly accepting who we are in a realistic way. So I'm bowing to it. And the bowing to it, I kind of add something a little bit different than acceptance, perhaps. Perhaps the bowing adds a sense of reverence or a sense of awe or a sense of love or a sense of sacredness or holiness or to this, you know, that this thing we're accepting. We're accepting or bowing to that which is inevitable. We are who we are, and we bow to that. And only by bowing to it or accepting it can we talk about being realistic change, about knowing how to change when we can change things about ourselves or the world around us. Oh, I wanted to read this poem. It seems like a good place. It's by William Stafford, and it's titled Tragedy. And he writes, "It happens. You knew it could. No one ever said it wouldn't, and now it has. The world just goes on. The air moves. Trees keep on standing there and maybe grieve a little. The sun stays steady. All of this can't stop for a person, no matter who, and the whole world has to rock now and then, but that's all. So people come by to talk and help if they can. They shake their heads helpfully. You'll get over it, they say. And maybe after years you do, or at least some of the time, when it's quiet or during music, you almost do." So then the idea of bowing to the inevitable. There's things that happen out of our control in our life. People die, we get sick. And the idea then of not just simply accepting it, but maybe bowing to it. And as Buddhists, what are Buddhists bowing to when they bow to the inevitable? The idea in Buddhism is that, in a sense, all of life is holy or sacred. And one way to see that Buddhists like to talk about, is again from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths, the Four Holy Truths, the Four Sacred Truths. That what is sacred for us is the possibility of life lived without resistance. And when reality confronts us and becomes our teacher to teach us how to have non-resistance, then we bow to that teaching. So when the inevitable happens, when someone dies, for example, it's inevitable, we suffer. But to put up resistance to that experience is adding to the suffering, adding to the pain. To bow to the inevitable is to bow to this experience as a teacher, leading us or helping us back to this experience of non-resistance, of freedom. So all things that come our way, then, are our teachers. All circumstances can be understood as our teachers. So there's a kind of a notion then in Buddhism that it's not a problem that suffering comes our way, exactly. Buddhism is helping us to be free of the suffering. But when circumstances and reality comes to us, it becomes our teacher, when it's necessary for us to be taught, to help us understand where is the resistance, where is the clinging that we contribute to the situation, which is not really a necessary part of the situation. So this poem by William Stafford, the pain doesn't go away sometimes. There is this kind of pain that lingers. He talks about it very realistically. And for me, this poem is kind of like a poem bowing to it. He's allowing for it. He's not fighting and resisting his own pain. He could be, and many times we do. But he just says, oh, this is the way it is. And he has this beautiful poem, which I kind of say is a bowing. There's no resistance to that pain. A religious life, a spiritual life, is an emotional life. And the idea of this non-resistance, of living in harmoniously without resistance, without clinging, isn't an emotionally neutral way of being in the world. But rather, it's a kind of a door through which a lot of emotions will bubble up and fill our life. And they're quite varied, depending on circumstances and what's going on. But with it comes often experiences of gratitude. After his enlightenment, the Buddha said, stood for 3 days, 7 days, facing the tree under which he was enlightened, kind of in thanks and gratitude for this tree. So the idea of gratitude coming out of our awakening, coming out of our practice. There can be a sense of awe, sometimes a sense of devotion, a sense of peace, a sense of acceptance, love, compassion, reverence. And also the last kind of feeling that I like to mention is humility. Humility is a very interesting word for us in the West, partly because we don't use it anymore. I don't think so. It used to be a quite popular word in Western civilization. And it did not have the connotations it has nowadays, I believe, of a weakness or meekness. But rather, I'll read my favorite definition of humility is by Dag Hammarskjöld. Humility is just as much the opposite of self-abasement as it is of self-exaltation. To be humble is not to make comparisons. Secure in its reality, the self is neither better nor worse, bigger nor smaller than anything else in the universe. It is nothing, yet at the same time, one with everything. To be humble is not to make comparisons. So not to make, as soon as we start comparing ourselves, I'm better than that's a person, I'm worse than that person, I'm right, that person's wrong. That is, I suggest, is a kind of resistance we put up to reality. And in and of itself, that adds suffering, certainly to ourselves, and sometimes, unfortunately, to our friends also. But to be humble, to have humility, is not to have a sense of comparing oneself to someone else in any kind of way, either arrogantly or so-called, humbly. But just to kind of be simple without resistance, to be the little, live your life as the little kind of farmer in the Chinese paintings, who's kind of doing, whatever that ideal represents. Just to go about our life in a kind of matter-of-fact way, accepting ourselves in all our varied aspects and not having it be good or bad, not having it be right or wrong. But this is who we are. And then we try to take care of the situation the best we can. So much suffering, as all of us know, come from comparative thinking. I'd be interested if we had to do a survey to find out how much of our suffering actually came from comparative thinking, comparing ourselves to others. So I'm especially inspired after sitting. I don't do it much in my role up here, but after sitting to bow like this. And part of it is that bowing after my sitting is a channel, is a vehicle to express some of the feelings that come when I sit and meditate. And often at the end of a sitting, there's a kind of feelings of gratitude or appreciation or devotion or reverence or whatever. And it's nice to have a channel for it, to have a way of expressing it. To bottle it up, you can kind of not express it, but I think, an unexpressed life is kind of not so interesting. So to have a way of expressing it, I think, is a beautiful thing to do. And then in return, what's interesting is when we express such things, they in return affect us. Doing things, expressing things with our body, communicating with our body, affects who we are. What we do with our body is maybe partly who we are, actually. So when we bow, we are in that moment someone who feels gratitude or reverence. We kind of strengthen those qualities, and they make it more likely for them to happen again, to feel those again. And that's what happened to me when I was living at the monastery at Tassajara. I just bowed at first just because you're supposed to bow. And then after a while I noticed that when I met someone, we were supposed to bow to someone when we crossed paths. By just bringing my hands together in front of my heart and kind of dipping my heart down towards them, that I would feel a sense of respect and appreciation of that person that was very different than if I just walked by and said, hey, or didn't say anything at all, just walked by. So one of the rules of Tassajara was you're supposed to bow to everyone you passed. And so sometimes people would see someone in the distance and they would kind of walk around the building. Just partly because it was so much, you're so much bowing. But it was a beautiful thing just to stop and bow. And so after living in Tassajara for almost 3 years and bowing to everyone in sight when I saw them, the first day I left, I was on College Avenue in Berkeley. And there's all these people there who are not who are not monastics. And I saw these people, I really wanted to kind of bow to them all. I thought it was really great, bow to these people. And they're going to lock me up, or this is really weird. I can't just walk up to strangers and bow to them. And then I remember seeing far in the distance this woman across the street who had been at Tassajara that summer. So some kind of vague acquaintance who kind of knew the scene. And I ran up to her and waved, hey, stop, stop. I really need to bow to someone. So it gave expression to what I was feeling. The Lotus Sutra, a famous East Asian Buddhist scripture, has a story of this guy who's called, I don't remember his name, Bodhisattva, maybe Ever Weeping? No, it's not it. But anyway, he thinks everybody's a Buddha, or everybody's going to be Buddha soon enough. So he goes around to everyone and bows to them as a Buddha. And people start beating him up because no one wants to be told they're a Buddha. And he gets all beat up and feels pretty bad, but he never gets discouraged. He just keeps it up and goes and bows to everyone. You're a Buddha. It's so great. Can you imagine what kind of life, what kind of world it would be?
Why don't people want to be told they're Buddha?
Elaine, you're a Buddha. So there's bowing as a salutation. You meet someone, you bow to them. And it's a different kind of expression than shaking hands. I like shaking hands. There's a place for shaking hands. Shaking hands expresses something different than bowing. But it is different. And so, and in the same way, bowing expresses something different than shaking hands. And if we never have a chance to bow, we actually miss a different kind of way of saluting someone or greeting someone. I think it's kind of, you know, in Hinduism it's called namaskara. It's said sometimes what you're bowing to is the divinity in the other person. And in Buddhism we don't have a divinity, so it's kind of, but anyway, we bow to the Buddha nature of that person. We bow to the sacredness. We bow to the fact that there's a human being. We simply bow out of reverence to this other human being. And I think it's a beautiful thing to bow to that kind of acceptance of someone else. I bow to your Buddha nature. I bow to your innermost wellsprings of compassion and joy and peace. It's a very deep form of respect. And this bowing to others and bowing to the depths in other people's makes more sense the more intimate we are with the depths of who we are. So the more we sit and quietly, kind of intently and honestly, become very intimate with the depths of who we are and find these wellsprings within ourselves, then I think it's a lot easier, almost natural, to want to bow to those in other people also. Because you can kind of see it and you sense it and you feel it, even when other people don't. And you bow to the others. There's sometimes, there's many different ways of bowing, but there's often this idea we bow as equals. When someone bows to you, return the bow, in a sense bowing to that which in them that they bow to, they're bowing to in you. It's said that sometimes the teacher bows to the student, sometimes the student bows to the teacher. Sometimes the husband bows to the wife, and sometimes the wife bows to the husband. But I think the idea of everybody bowing together, kind of in deep respect. And then there's the last thing I'll mention, is the idea of bowing to an altar, or bowing to an icon. Bowing to a Buddha statue. Two things to say. One is, one notion is that when you bow to a Buddha statue, you're really bowing to yourself. Or you don't want to set up a duality that you're bowing to something outside of yourself. And if you have some idea that you're bowing to something outside of yourself, then you've misunderstood what you're bowing to. And when you bow to a Buddha statue, you're actually bowing to yourself, or bowing to that which is within you, or bowing to that deep sense of intimacy where there's no inside or outside. And so they're kind of, and again, it's the same thing as bowing to other people. The more we kind of have a deeper realization of ourselves, I think the more we have a sense that we bow to a Buddha, it's kind of really we're bowing to ourselves, or bowing to this wonderful piece of reality, aspect of reality, that comes in all of us when the heart has no resistance. Also, in more monastic situations, or more formal situations, and some teachers, Vipassana teachers do this also, before they give a Dharma talk, they'll bow to the Buddha, which I think is a very beautiful thing to do. And what's being expressed there, I think, is that the person who's going, the person who's speaking, is speaking as an equal to the people listening. That all of us, in a sense, are disciples or students of the Buddha. That the person speaking as someone else feels a certain kind of humility or something like, you know, I'm just a kind of, my understanding is only partial. I don't understand very well. I only have a partial understanding of reality, of Buddhism, of spiritual life. And there's somebody, there's people, there's more to be known, there's more to be studied. And I, in my humble way, will try to do my best to explain what I know. And so kind of at the beginning of a talk, to express that. At Zen Center, in the San Francisco Zen Center, everybody else is sitting, actually, waiting for the talk. And the person who's going to give a talk will come in and actually do full prostrations, getting down all the way onto the floor, touching their heads to the floor, before they're going to give that talk. And I think it gives a nice sense that, you know, this person sitting up here isn't this, you know, great, you know, guru or whatever who knows all the truth and knows everything, and you're supposed to kind of be in reverence of this person. It's more like that person comes out of the group and does the best they can, but they also realize how little they know, perhaps. So, of course, I should be bowing here every time I come. But part of the reason I do so little bowing here in this situation, the end of sitting or whatever, is really because I want it to be a place where people who don't, not used to the scene, can come and feel comfortable. And if I do the bowing, then it becomes a ritual. I'm afraid it becomes a ritual that other people will mimic me, because, you know, teacher is kind of like, you know, the example. So I kind of like just kind of, for the time being, someday I'll start. But for the time being, I feel like I still want to keep the ritual out, at least here. Yes?
When you bow to others, are you briefly establishing eye contact with them, or is there no eye contact?
It depends. Sometimes I do.
Either way.
Either way. I think sometimes it depends on what's being communicated, I think. And sometimes it's kind of nice to make the eye contact, and sometimes it's nice to kind of go a little bit further down than actually eye contact would allow for. Kind of to express kind of deeper sense of respect or... Yes?
If you run into a large group of people, you can't, you don't have time to bow to all of them, can you just go and give them all one bow?
Sure. Yeah, you don't have to go around to each one, you just kind of... You can just, yeah. Yes.
First, thank you for the talk this evening. You've expressed a lot of things that I've felt as over the last year as I've been bowing, and I found it to be very powerful in inducing a sense of connectedness and gratitude and the other things that you were saying. And but because we hadn't talked about it here and it wasn't formalized, I didn't know if I was kind of alone when I was feeling or atypical or, you know, you just, like, and it expresses something that I don't know another way to express. It's, handshakes are kind of impersonal and business-like,
right,
and things. You know, hugging's a little bit on the other extreme, but that need to acknowledge another being with respect, gratitude, love. There's nothing else, and like you after leaving Tassajara, I find myself wanting to bow to people and having to stop myself because I know they're not going to understand it at all, but it's almost just kind of comes up.
One of the nice things about bowing is that it also involves, in a sense, involves all of us coming together, both sides, left and right, and all of us coming there. When you bow, it's easy enough to kind of bow kind of with only part of ourselves, kind of with less commitment. There's more commitment of ourselves when we bow, I believe. Yes?
If there's time, could you explain a little bit about prostration as another kind of bowing? Or?
Well, when you really get into it, you know, you can you can just do it, you know, even more thoroughly and throw yourself on the floor. And there's And there's different ways of doing that, full prostrations. The most extreme is what you see in Tibetan Buddhism, where you actually make yourself completely flat. With hands straight out and legs straight out, and you're completely prone. In Zen, you're actually kind of on your knees, and then from your knees you go down and touch your head, so you kind of bend down. It's a nice thing to do. It involves much more of the body. If you do a lot of it, it's a nice exercise. But there are people who do full prostrations as a practice, and they say that it actually affects them in a deep way, kind of transforms them in subtle ways from maybe the kind of excessive self-centeredness we have, or makes them more open or more patient, or the full bows. Yes. As you wish.
Sometimes I see in retreats, sometimes when someone wants to cut in front of me or whatever, they'll come up and they'll do like sort of half. I always wondered where that is. That just a short thing? I was like this.
Yeah, I don't know.
One-handed bow.
Yeah, it was nice to see you. Well, but sometimes not, even when there's not holding.
When you're holding something in your hand, rather than bowing with one hand, you hold actually with both hands the thing, and then you bow like this. So you have everything comes together, rather than being kind of split in what you do.
I bow to my food before I eat when I'm by myself, but when I'm with company, I feel self-conscious, you know, to do that. But I want to do it, you know?
Yes, last one, and then we'll stop.
I'm glad you don't, because to me it makes me very uncomfortable and it feels contrived.
Yeah, what you're expressing is very nice, is that I think it's nice to be able to offer a practice in a scene, an environment, where in the context of being mindful and doing the practice, that we find ourselves. And so, and eventually, if you find yourself bowing, then that's great. But rather than feeling like it's a duty or requirement, and that's a beautiful thing to offer it. To have to be that open and free, and that's kind of the spirit in which I like mindfulness practice being offered. However, there's also something wonderful to be said about going to a monastery and just adopting the form, whether you like it or not, and just doing it. Dealing with the resistance, right? Remember, dealing with the resistance is what makes it sacred. If you don't deal with the resistance, it's not sacred.
The resistance
isn't sacred? What? Dealing with the resistance is what makes it all sacred. But if we don't deal with the resistance, we kind of just go along with the resistance and act it out. There's no sacredness there. So, those of you who like. Thank you all.